Good morning and welcome to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. For centuries, criminals knew that the way to escape paying for their crimes was to skip town, cross the county line, get out of the state, leave the country. Jesse James and his gang extended their criminal careers by skedaddling a lot. By the 1930s, the method had been perfected by the likes of the Barrow Gang, Bonnie and Clyde, by Pretty Boy Floyd, Machine Gun Kelly, and the rest. Grab the money, shoot who you need to, and take off for another jurisdiction. Most sheriffs and police in those days had precious few tools to investigate crimes and nearly none to track down criminals once they were gone. That's why Kansas, in the late 1930s, instituted its own crime-fighting unit, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, the KBI. Today's guest was the head of that agency, Kansas chief crime buster for 13 years. He's Larry Welch, and he's the author of Beyond Cold Blood, the KBI from Ma Barker to BTK. It's just been published by the University Press of Kansas. Larry Welch, welcome to Central Standard Friday.
Thank you, Monroe. Appreciate being here, and I appreciate your interest in the book.
Now, you were director of the KBI from 1994 until you retired in 2007, and so you're pretty well positioned to know about a lot of its history. Let's start at the beginning, which was in the 30s. Why did Kansas need this agency?
Well, it needed the agency because of the situation you described, specifically the lawlessness of the 30s. And it was created, actually, because of the lobbying by three particular associations: the Kansas Bankers Association, the Kansas State Peace Officers Association, and the Kansas Livestock Commission. Those three associations, and in particular the Kansas Bankers Association and the Kansas State Peace Officers Association, they lobbied tirelessly for almost a decade, almost the entire 1930s, trying to persuade the Kansas legislature to create a state investigative agency because of those gangsters you described who were indeed roaming across the state of Kansas and across the Midwest, robbing banks, committing homicides, robbing people, committing kidnappings. But the legislature was fearful of creating such an agency, apparently, because it was a very reluctant legislature that finally did cave in, and the governor and the attorney general were able to get the KBI created in the session of the 1939 state legislature, but only at the very end. And then, with certain limitations, the KBI was originally limited to 9 agents, 1 director, and 1 secretary, and a very limited budget.
You would think those would be three pretty powerful lobbies, the bankers, the peace officers, and the livestock raisers, and yet it took them most of the decade to accomplish this. There was fear of a state police or something that...
Right. I don't understand it either, even today, and I've read an awful lot about it in my original research. But that was the fact. And the Highway Patrol had been created, as I recall, in 1937, but again, fearfully. But these three associations had been trying throughout the decade to get an investigative agency created because, as you said, local sheriffs, local police chiefs, local departments were unable to cope with the gangsters that were committing crimes across the state.
And bankers were tired of getting robbed,
yes,
and livestock,
yes,
people were tired of having their cattle stolen.
They were tired of losing the money that they were losing and tired of paying rewards to other agencies. In fact, there were incidents where the Kansas Bankers Association had paid Missouri authorities and Oklahoma authorities for capturing bandits who had robbed Kansas banks. And later the KBI came along and didn't charge anybody anything. So they liked that.
Early on, livestock thefts and marijuana busts were the big
right.
items?
Cattle rustling was almost as serious as the bank robbery situation.
And the marijuana bust thing is interesting because when we come full circle toward the end of your tenure there, drugs will become again a big thing. But I don't think of marijuana as being a huge problem in the early 1940s, but that just shows how little
right.
we know about that era.
In fact, the first official letter after the creation in 1939 of the KBI, the first official letter that Lou Ritker, the first KBI director, sent out to Kansas law enforcement included a paragraph or two about the marijuana weed, as he described it. And he spelled marijuana with an H rather than a J. But he described it as an evil, evil threat to the young people of Kansas. And, of course, he was right. Hmm. But that's always been with us.
Now, the KBI's first big shoot-'em-up, or it might have been shoot-'em-up, began with a prison break of six inmates from Lansing. Fascinating story. It's the first big crime the agency faced and the first one you tell about in the book. Tell us about the Maxville incident.
Well, in my research, and of course I want to emphasize, Monroe, that this is not the history of the KBI, but it is a history of the KBI. And when I decided, and I worked on this for about 9 years in writing this book, but I was careful in selecting the cases that I use to describe the history, a history. And I picked this one because it came early. And in my opinion, two cases in the history of the KBI are vital to the KBI, the Clutter obviously being one. But it was, I think, the Maxville attempted robbery of the Maxville Bank in 1941 that guaranteed, that ensured the existence of the KBI. Because, again, remember, it was a very reluctant Kansas legislature that created the KBI to begin with. But when these five criminals escaped from Lansing, the Attorney General at that time in 1941 gave this assignment immediately to the KBI. These were five dangerous career criminals. And the Attorney General gave this first major assignment to the KBI. Catch those five, put them back in Lansing, and let's be done with it. And three were fairly easily and quickly captured. But then the other two managed to get out of Kansas and, as it turned out, get into Colorado. And those two, of course, later ended up attempting to rob the Maxville Bank. And in the gunfight that resulted, they were, of course, shot and killed. And the state of Kansas exploded with media acclaim and praise for the KBI. And all of a sudden, the legislature was taking great credit for creating the KBI. The Attorney General was ecstatic, the governor was happy, and the state of Kansas was happy. And so that case, I think, ensured the existence for the KBI. And later, Clutter gave the KBI the notoriety nationally and internationally that it then enjoyed.
You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd. With us is Larry Welch, who for 13 years was director of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. Larry has a new book, Beyond Cold Blood, which tells the history of the KBI. Just to stick with Maxville for a quick second, you have a couple of interesting sidelights on that. One was that the two guys were, the ambush was figured out by virtue of an undercover. One of the first 10 agents of the KBI went undercover and got into these guys' confidence.
Yes, yeah, he did a marvelous job. Joe Anderson was his name, and the first director, again, Lou Ritker, former Kansas sheriff, had assigned Joe personally to track down these two because they knew that by then the two were, they had been spotted in the Colorado Badlands along the Kansas border, and he had kind of infiltrated them and learned what their plans were, that they intended to rob a bank in Maxville. Happened to be two banks there, but he did a marvelous job in learning their plans and the approximate week. And it so happened that then the Stafford County Sheriff and the Undersheriff and five KBI agents, including the director himself, staked out both banks all that week. Later, that Stafford County Sheriff also became a KBI agent and later became the second director of the KBI. So there's a lot involved in Maxville.
Now, Maxville is in the Pratt vicinity in south-central southwestern Kansas.
Well, it's right between Great Bend on the north and Pratt on the south, or Dodge City on the west and Hutchinson on the east. More importantly, it happens to be the home county of myself and my wife, Shirley. Shirley is from Maxville.
In fact, when the shootout occurred, and that was when the KBI agents and law enforcement authorities confronted these two guys who were about to rob the bank, the two guys drew and the gunfire. There was a little girl who came by to look at it and was shooed away by her father, and that's your wife today.
That's right. Shirley saw the aftermath. In those days, it was customary to lay out the dead bodies of the bad guys, and she did indeed see the bodies of the two would-be bank robbers laid out in the street, and Her mother had sent her down. Her siblings were all in school that day, and she was between 5 and 6 years old and not in school. They didn't have kindergarten in Maxville. We did in St. John. Of course, we were a lot larger than Maxville.
I think of the pictures of the Dalton gang after their failed robbery in Coffeyville,
right,
with the bodies laid out on the street.
Right.
This was still the practice even in the 1940s?
Yes, it was. Yeah, I guess that's supposed to be a message to would-be criminals, perhaps, but didn't always work, obviously.
A deterrent. Now, that first group of agents, and there were only 9 of them and the director, mm-hmm, had a lot in common in their resumes. What kind of things did they
share?
Well,
obviously, Lou Richter, who was a Kansas sheriff himself, of the 9 agents that he picked, there was a common denominator there. Most were former sheriffs or under sheriffs or had worked for sheriff's departments. So they were almost without exception native Kansans as well. They had been Kansas lawmen, highly experienced.
Now, you quote that first director as saying a good agent should be able to get along with people who use 4-letter words as well as he does with people who use 4-syllable words.
That's right.
A good agent is for the KBI, or I guess for any other agency, is it somebody who just believes strongly in the social compact that people ought not to break law? What makes the clock tick on a good investigative agent?
Oh, I think it's a combination of experience and common sense and well-balanced individual and one who wants to work within the law. And again, I think one thing that has always guided the KBI is the target is justice and not just prosecution. And I think one of the chapters in my book, Samaritan, indicates that, proves that. That's a unique chapter that I chose because that's a case where a Kansas City, Kansas judge had decided that justice had not been obtained in his courtroom. He was troubled by the conviction of 2 young women. He felt they were innocent of the charge, armed robbery in that case, and he asked the KBI to look into that particular situation. And the KBI investigation by a very, very determined agent proved that indeed those 2 young women had been wrongfully convicted. And as a result of his investigation, those 2 young women were exonerated and freed from prison.
Oh, my gosh, it worked both ways for the KBI. Mm-hmm. Now, another thing that first 10, and it grew slowly in numbers over the years, they had in common was precious little equipment. At first, they were asked to use their own automobiles.
That's right. That's
they
right.
Didn't have radios.
That's right.
It's amazing, but as times change, lots of other stuff change, including the nature of the crimes. You write that by the early 1950s, burglaries dominated the work of the agency.
Well, I don't know that it dominated, but it certainly became one of the top priorities. Homicide has always, through the years, seemed to be the bread and butter, so to speak, of the KBI. And, of course, one of the guiding premises has always been that the the KBI goes where they're called. They don't just, you know, go herky-jerky into a situation that appeals to them. The cases come from requests from the police chief or the sheriff, the prosecutor, or the attorney general, or rarely the governor, something like that. But Lou Ritker and, again, Logan Sanford, the second director, they set those guidelines that the KBI is an assisting agency and will go take their resources and go assist when requested, when asked for help.
And even today, sheriffs and policemen in small towns and counties in Kansas, of which there are quite a few, are severely stressed any time a major crime occurs for investigative tools.
Well, 73% of local law enforcement agencies in the state of Kansas have 10 or fewer full-time officers. 52% today have 5 or fewer full-time officers. So, and it's been that way traditionally across the state. So KBI resources have always been very, very important to local law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. And no better example of that, perhaps, than the Clutter murders, which you mentioned earlier. With respect to all the other KBI agents who have served the agency, no doubt, well over time, the one who sticks in the popular mind is probably Alvin Dewey. He was made famous by Truman Capote in Cold Blood. And you write, and you've said today, that that case, probably more than any other, symbolized the KBI in its work.
Yeah, I think so. It was really daunting to write about the Clutter case because, well, again, you know, how do you improve on the book
yeah.
Truman Capote wrote? How do you improve on the movie that was done? There were several movies that followed that were not done well, but certainly the original Robert Blake movie was done well, in my humble opinion, and also by Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, you know, how do you, what can you add to what Truman Capote wrote, and indeed what's been written by a lot of other people? And yet, how can you write a history of the KBI without attempting to touch on the Clutter killing? So, and the same thing was true of BTK. So much has been written about BTK and written well, and yet I had to include a chapter on BTK. But, yes, Clutter, you just cannot do any story of the KBI without Clutter and Al Dewey.
Those murders took place more than half a century ago, and yet they still are fascinating. The whole thing began with Dick Hickok sitting in a prison cell with a guy named Wells and hearing what turned out to be a fabulous and wrong story about a farmer's big cache of money.
Very, very wrong, right. But we had, when I was director, and I'm sure nothing's changed, we had more public inquiries and requests about the Clutter case than all other KBI cases combined. I had one employee, an assistant director, who I assigned to handle all those inquiries because there were so many. I don't mean that we were belabored with them every day, but we had an awful lot of inquiries from across the nation about that case all the time.
It's difficult to conceive of a more misbegotten crime. The guy goes on this fanciful tale. And Dick Hickok, I'm talking about,
right.
who was from Edgerton in Johnson County
right.
at the times where
Absolutely.
He lived with his parents. And he concocts a scheme. He lures Perry Smith out to do it, and it'll be easy money.
Right.
And it turns into this awful murders of four people in a family, and they got at best $40 or $50 out of mm-hmm. the whole thing because there was no safe. There was no money. And in fact, the first investigators on the scene seemed to have thought that the brutality of the murders indicated it was revenge or something that would be a mm-hmm. passionate crime rather than the murders of people by people who didn't know them.
Right. In fact, you described the situation very well. Al Dewey was a friend of mine. I knew Al Dewey. To this day, I use half and half cream on my cereal because of Al Dewey, because he influenced me in that regard. But Al Dewey once said that prior to them crossing the threshold of the Clutter home, Hickok was the dominant figure. But once they crossed the threshold, Perry Smith, strangely, became the dominant figure. And, of course, Perry Smith actually killed every member of that family rather than Hickok, although Hickok carried the flashlight and picked up the shell casings and went right along with Perry Smith. They both were extremely guilty.
He planned the crime, but he didn't plan the quite as brutal and bloody as all of that. Dick Hickok was basically a small-time con artist.
Right. And a good high school athlete, I understand.
I understand he played basketball, and I spoke once with a guy who was a part-time law enforcement adjunct, I guess, in Edgerton, who said that that Dick Hickok had actually been known to steal the dimes and the nickels from the little March of Dimes things that sat on store counters. He was such a petty.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
But then when they went through the door, according to Alvin Dewey, Perry Smith, whose mind was. It's almost impossible to fathom. Something took him over, and he became a killing machine.
Right.
Now, you mentioned Alvin Dewey. He was the KBI agent posted in Garden City.
That's why he was, as we say, the case agent. Yeah, it became his major responsibility. Of course, four agents were assigned by Logan Sanford, the director at the time, to handle the investigation. A lot of agents worked on that case, and, of course, Finney County Sheriff's Office worked on the case as well. In fact, the KBI was assigned an office within the Finney County Sheriff's Office to work on that case. So it was, as always in these cases, it was a cooperative effort between the local department and the KBI. And in fact, the case was one of the reasons the case was solved was the extraordinary photography that was done by the assistant chief of police of the Garden City Police Department, Al Rowletter, whose strange double exposure photograph taken at the crime scene itself revealed that for the first time it was realized there were two different boot sole prints. And so there were two people involved, not just one.
They were made in the blood that was left.
That's right.
Oh, my gosh.
And that that print is in a display case at KBI headquarters today.
Alvin Dewey befriended Truman Capote and Harper Lee when they were out there doing the book. In fact, Alvin Dewey and his wife were invited to one of Truman Capote's fabulous cocktail parties in New York, as I understand.
Actually, Marie Dewey befriended Nell Harper Lee and Truman Capote first, much to Al Dewey's dismay. In fact, she met them in a grocery store when Capote and Lee were doing the research on the book and invited them to dinner that night without Al Dewey knowing it. And then later they did indeed become friends of sort. But I remember Al telling that story, how he was stunned when he learned Marie had invited Truman Capote and Nell Harper Lee to dinner that night.
Well, this is wonderful talking about crime in Kansas. If you'd like to join us after the break and talk about crimes in Kansas or the work of the KBI or what it's like to run an agency like that, call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And we'll be back after the break to hear more about Kansas' most memorable crimes with our guest, Larry Welch. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. And welcome back to Central Standard Friday. I'm Monroe Dodd. We're talking about the Kansas Bureau of Investigation with its director for 13 years, Larry Welch. Larry is author of a book, Beyond Cold Blood, The KBI from Ma Barker to BTK, and was just published by the University Press of Kansas. It tells the story of the Bureau and details the solving of some of Kansas' biggest crimes. You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. Larry, after the clutter matter was settled, the KBI, I don't know if it was related to that or not, but by the middle 1960s, the KBI had even become a model for other states, Colorado, for instance.
Well, one of the reasons there was Logan Sanford, again, the second director, had some friends in Colorado, and Colorado at that time was trying to create a Colorado Bureau of Investigation, and they called on Logan to go out and appear before the Colorado legislature and testify in support of such a creation in Colorado. And Logan did. He made two or three trips out there and explained how the KBI worked. And also at that time, a lot of Colorado sheriffs who, along the Kansas line in particular, who had worked cases or had some association with KBI agents in that area, also testified, and Logan and those sheriffs were instrumental in persuading the legislature of Colorado that it was worth the risk to create the CBI, and that was done. And there's always been a close relationship between the Colorado Bureau and the Kansas Bureau because of Logan and his efforts to get that done.
And probably also because of Interstate 70 making the link between the states so tight.
There's been a lot of interaction between our two states.
Speaking of Interstate 70, one of the horrific crimes you talk about in the book, is one of the horrific criminals, I think, is Francis Donald Nemechek.
Yes.
Who did what he did in the 1970s, but I think a lot of people may not remember him. Could you remind us about his acts?
Well, it is amazing how many Kansans are unfamiliar with Mr. Nemechek. He did ravage three counties in western Kansas, killed four young women along Interstate 70, and let the toddler son of one of those women die of exposure in the brutal winter weather. This was, as you said, in the 70s. He was literally, in modern times, perhaps our first Kansas serial killer, but slightly before BTK, Dennis Rader. But he haunted Interstate 70 and would, for instance, the first situation where he literally shot out the tires one night of two travelers, two young women traveling with the toddler, as a matter of fact, and then abducted them from their now disabled car and took them out into an area that he was familiar with in Graham County and raped both and killed both. Later killed two more, one a KU co-ed from Hayes along Interstate 70. He was captured through the efforts of local authorities and KBI, and is still today in prison doing life.
He shot out the tires of other people too. He would get in an argument with his wife and go get drunk and then just go out and do this.
Yeah, he had kind of similar to Dennis Rader. He later claimed he had overwhelming urges that he couldn't control, but. Mm-hmm. I presume he's controlling them in prison.
Well, you've mentioned the BTK case several times here, so let's go back to that. That also began in the 1970s, but it wasn't solved for decades. Dennis Rader and the BTK Strangler case.
Right. Well, again, that one we had to put in because it was so important in the history of Kansas. And, again, it's a Wichita case, a Wichita Police Department case. But I was really pleased when he reemerged. Of course, as you say, he was dormant, so to speak, for quite a number of years. But when he reemerged, Ken Landwehr, a friend of mine, who headed up the homicide squad in Wichita Police Department, called and asked if he could borrow a couple of my agents from our cold case squad. And I was very pleased that he did that, and because, of course, I had been stationed with the FBI in Wichita for years, and my wife and I raised our children in Goddard, a suburb of Wichita, for 25 years, and was quite familiar with BTK. And so the original BTK task force consisted of Lieutenant Landwehr in command, and six Wichita City detectives, two FBI agents, and two KBI agents. And the one of the main reasons, and of course, my head of my biology section, my DNA specialist, Cindy Schuler, is the one that indirectly connected the daughter's DNA, the daughter of BTK. Her DNA was identified as being the DNA of the offspring of Dennis Rader, mm-hmm. and connected that to three of the early cases of BTK. But we, you know, the thing I emphasize in the book, it was the great work of the early Wichita police officers in the Otero cases and two others, where that evidence was collected mm-hmm. before DNA had ever been heard of, mm-hmm. collected, retained, maintained, and that permitted that identification to be done.
These are terrible crimes. The initial name he gave himself, BT and K, stood for bind, torture, and kill.
That's right.
If you were a writer of cheap, sordid crime novels, you couldn't come up with a more lurid name than that.
That's true.
And yet he eluded people for 30 years.
What, yeah. Right? And you know, as much as anything else, it was just blind, dumb luck. This guy was not brilliant, but blind, dumb luck. But in the end, his ego and his arrogance proved to be his downfall.
He wrote taunting letters,
and when Ken told me about the one letter that where he reemerged, he actually got angry because the Wichita Eagle did a nice story on the anniversary of BTK, and in there it was mentioned that several people were now thinking about writing the story of BTK. People were presuming at the time that he had died or that he was in the institution or something like that. There had to be some reason for his years and years and years, so more than 20 years of silence or absence. And this, when he heard that people were going to write a book, going to do the story of BTK, that obviously made him mad. And he lashed out and wrote a letter to the Wichita PD and said, by gosh, I'm not dead, and here are the facts on all these murders. I did that, and... And so his own arrogance, if he'd kept his mouth shut, which he could not do, and it was after he was captured, you know, they couldn't shut him up for 3 days. So
you're right that he almost proudly told how he did stuff and showed things.
Oh, he did.
To his captors.
And indeed confessed to two. Originally, the thought was he had killed eight, and he added two that they had not been sure of. So that's why everybody is certain that we do know of all his victims.
Now, your agency from the beginning has supposed to have been insulated from politics, yet the directors of the KBI all report to an elected official, a guy who has to run for office, the Attorney General. So any insulation, it must be the director's job to do that.
Right.
Over time, what kind of political pressures has the agency faced?
Well, I don't know that I can attest that none of the attorneys general that I served four, none of them ever asked me, well, in fact, they never even asked me what my political affiliation was, and none ever asked me to have agents do anything that smacked of any kind of political activity. I personally, as long as I was in law enforcement, I never ever participated in any political campaign. I never went to anybody's election headquarters. I never, the only political activity I ever participated in was I voted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after I retired, I did participate in a couple of campaigns and tried to assist a couple of friends. But as long as I was on the job and in law enforcement, I never did, and I'm not aware that any of my nine predecessors ever did either. But you're right, you're surrounded by politics all the time. In fact, the original offices of the KBI were indeed in the Capitol.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about being surrounded by politics.
And I can't help but believe that more than once an ambitious young or old politician must have dropped in to say, hey, why don't you try this or try that?
Yeah. Well, and I can't say that I didn't have a couple, three legislators through the years,
mm-hmm.
you know, ask for things. But I never, my boss was always the Attorney General, whoever the Attorney General was. And I never had an attorney general ask me what party I was a member of or suggest any improper action by the KBI.
Okay. You're listening to Central Standard Friday on KCUR. I'm Monroe Dodd here with Larry Welch, former director of the Kansas Bureau of Investigation. You can join our conversation by calling 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You have another powerful chapter in the book about the slaying of Stephanie Schmidt, who is from right here in the Kansas City area, mm-hmm. Leawood, down at Pittsburgh State University, by a guy named Gideon.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that occurred before my time, too. That was very similar to another Pittsburgh State co-ed who was killed by Kleypas,
mm-hmm.
Carey, and two very, very similar situations, and both resulted in legislation that, poor consolation, but some good did come out of those two terrible, terrible tragedies. But, of course, you referred to Stephanie in that situation, that Johnson County girl originally, daughter of Jean and Peggy Schmidt. She was killed by an individual who had been released just recently from prison,
mm-hmm.
and on parole and guilty of some bad crimes. But his co-workers were not aware of those convictions, and he ended up abducting Stephanie and raping and killing her.
And this led to something called Stephanie's Law to try to prevent that.
Right.
What does Stephanie's Law do?
Stephanie's Law provides that you have to notify the workers, the colleagues, the classmates of such convictions by that person.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a powerful chapter in the book about methamphetamine, its arrival in Kansas and seemingly to take over much of rural Kansas and all the bad things that can occur as a result of that. And this occurred during your tenure as director.
In fact, that was probably my biggest nemesis. That was my biggest scourge as director. And indeed, I dare say it was probably the biggest nemesis and scourge of Kansas law enforcement during the 90s and the early 2000s in Kansas. In 1994, my first year in the KBI, the KBI seized four meth labs and that was a state record. By 2000 and 2001, 2002, Kansas law enforcement was seizing 700, 800, 900 wow. meth labs. We were beleaguered, to say the least. All of Kansas law enforcement was, because meth labs just exploded across the state. And Missouri was having a worse time than we were. The Midwest, Iowa, Oklahoma, we were being overrun with meth labs, and it was destroying our budgets. We still have way too many meth labs, but not quite as bad as it was then. We finally were getting resources financially from our congressional delegations through federal grants. Our labs were absolutely backlogged with our chemistry sections, with departments all across the state crying for meth examinations. It was really bad. It was the biggest danger we had in Kansas. It was destroying communities.
Because methamphetamine makes people do just awful things and not even realize it.
That's right.
And yet meth could be concocted from easily available, legally available materials in a trailer or a hut or a house or a tent, I guess.
And these, you know, there wasn't much consolation in the fact that these, in Kansas especially, our meth labs were small quantity meth labs, because a meth lab is a meth lab, and it takes so much work to uncover them, and they're all literally hazardous waste sites. Mm-hmm. They cause a lot of damage to wherever they are. Plus, they're dangerous, physically dangerous. They have booby traps. Never seen a. They're always, well, not always, but they're quite often occupied by armed people. The FBI dubbed them the most dangerous assignment a law enforcement officer can receive. Wow. To engage in a raid on a meth lab. We lost a good sheriff in Greenwood County. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's one of the chapters in there. I follow the chapter on meth with a chapter on Matt, who is Matt Samuels, sheriff of Greenwood County. He was ambushed and killed as he was routinely serving a warrant on an individual. He was not aware there was a meth lab in progress there, and he was shot and killed. But it was a terrible, terrible evil. Still is a terrible, terrible evil.
He's an example. This is Greenwood County, is I think east or southeast of Wichita, mm-hmm. of a small
That's right.
department.
That's right. And but and that resulted, that got the legislature's attention, mm-hmm. sadly. Tough way to do it. But that resulted in the Matt Samuels Chemical Control Act, which put the ingredients involved in the manufacture of methamphetamine under somewhat control, and it greatly reduced the number of meth labs then that we had to face. But, you know, there's always good news and bad news. I'd always told the legislature that 80% of the methamphetamine in Kansas wasn't from that local manufacturer anyway, although it was taking 80% of our time to deal with it. Mm-hmm. The reason we needed to get meth labs under control was that 80% of the meth in Kansas to begin with was imported into Kansas from outside. It was Mexican meth. Mm. You know, it arrived wrapped in Mexican newspapers. Mm. So it wasn't manufactured in Greenwood County or Elk County or Finney County or anywhere else in Kansas.
You cover a lot of ground in your book. What of all the chapters was your favorite?
Well, probably my favorite chapter, and I picked it. There's usually a reason behind every case that I picked, like Samaritan that I described and Maxville and Clutter. But the chapter on Michael Pyle, who killed his grandmother in Kiowa County. in 1971. That case is important, and one of the least known cases. Several of these, like Nemechek, most people don't know about them. But in Pyle, that case is important because that was the first case in Kansas where a successful homicide conviction was upheld without benefit of the body. The victim's body there, Pyle's grandmother, a very successful rancher, widow, her body was never found. But the Kansas Supreme Court upheld the conviction without that body due to the overwhelming probable cause from the circumstances. It was completely circumstantial evidence. Another case involving Al Dewey, by the way. But it took place in Kiowa County, west of Pratt. And I think it shows the sheriff, Bill Hogan, of Kiowa County, and Dwayne Bell, a KBI agent at Pratt, and Al Dewey, who came in from Garden City to help. And those three people put together this case where Pyle was convicted. The Kansas Supreme Court upheld it. And today, State versus Pyle is cited in cases where there is no corpus delicti, no body of the victim. And in Kansas, we've now had 8 or 9 such cases, and Pyle is always cited. And indeed, State versus Pyle is cited across the country in other states for that reason.
Yeah, the case of Richard Grissom and the women who've disappeared and whose bodies have never been found.
Pyle was cited in Grissom. In fact, Shirley, my wife, would tell you that on TV when we're watching a Law and Order or CSI case and the prosecutor says, well, we can't convict him without the body, she now beats me to yelling out, yes, you can.
Yes,
we do it in Kansas. So that case is very, very important. It doesn't get the attention that it deserves.
Your book was a labor of love. You took 9 years to do it. What inspired you, unlike all the other KBI directors, to write a book?
Well, one of the reasons was that nobody else had ever written a history of the KBI, and I felt the agency deserved to have a history written. The thing close to a history of the KBI that had been written was an internal document that was written on the 50th anniversary of the KBI by the KBI itself in 1989. But it wasn't for public consumption. It was a well-done book, but a few libraries have copies, but all the other copies went to employees, and none of my 9 predecessors had ever written anything resembling a history or a memoir or autobiography. So number one, I was a KBI fan before I ever came to the KBI, again, because Logan Sanford, the second director, was always a mentor of mine. I visited with him when I was KU Law School. He had been a reference of mine when I entered the FBI. I always, was a big fan of the KBI and just thought it something ought to be done.
Were there some things you had to avoid talking about because you were a fan? Or?
Well, yeah, there's nothing in there that came out of classified material or confidential material. One of the big things that helped me was my secretary for 13 years, PJ Adair, Paula Jean. She maintained for me, and I hadn't asked her to do it. She just automatically did it. She would keep copies of the public letters that I wrote to the legislature, my annual reports, letters that I wrote to law enforcement, because almost without exception, I would copy media with things that I wrote to the legislature and to the governor, or the attorney general. And so she built my own personal archives, if you will, while I was director there. And so I had a great store of public information that I could use, a lot of newspaper clippings as well. So I had that material, and I knew I always wanted to write a book. So,
in the few seconds we have remaining, we have a question from someone on Twitter about any notorious hideouts of Kansas criminals. Can you think of one?
Lansing.
Where sometimes they worked in the coal yard downstairs and could dig their way out, like those guys in Maxwell, Kansas. Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. We've been talking about the Kansas Bureau of Investigation and its history, investigating some of Kansas' biggest crimes. Our guest has been Larry Welch, former director of the Bureau and author of Beyond Cold Blood, the KBI from Ma Barker to BTK. It was just published by the University Press of Kansas. Larry, thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, and thank you, Monroe.
Now, for more information on our guests and upcoming shows, visit our website, kcur.org. Central Standard Friday was produced by Tamika Witherspoon. Our announcer has been Michael Byers. I'm Monroe Dodd. Thanks for joining us, and I'm sure Larry Welch joins me in saying, stay out of trouble, but enjoy your weekend.